Today you're tuning in live to Queering the Air on 3CR Community Radio with myself, Tan Hung, and Iris in the studio. We also have a very special guest who will be joining us in a minute, Virginia Fraser. But first I'd like to acknowledge country. So just like to acknowledge that Queering the Air on 3CR is broadcasting from stolen, unceded lands of the Kulin Nation. We'd like to acknowledge that genocide happened on these lands, that colonial violence continues to happen on this land, and that a treaty has yet to be signed. We'd like to pay our respect to the owners of this land, the Wurundjeri and Boonwurrung peoples, and the elders in those communities. We'd like to pay our respect to any elders and Indigenous people who are tuning into 3CR right now. I'd also like to do an acknowledgement in one of my main languages, Vietnamese, for any Vietnamese people who are perhaps listening out there right now. So, chúng chung này, trên lãnh thổ Kulin, từ trước đến nay và vĩnh viễn của Yom Yang, Wurundjeri và Boonwurrung. Vì thế, cha kính trọng nhung tiếng bối và sự tiếp nói văn hóa từ mảnh đất này. So this week has been NAIDOC week. It's been a big week. And NAIDOC week should really be every week of the year. But yeah, so I guess it's really, we have a really special show for you Queering the Air listeners today. We're going to be doing a special show dedicated to Lisa Belair. And for those who don't know Lisa Belair was a Minjungbul Gornpil Nunukul Kanak woman, an Indigenous activist, photographer, broadcaster, poet, feminist, academic and performer. She was widely admired within the Australian Indigenous community and was rarely seen without her camera, documenting two decades of Indigenous community life. By 2006, she had created a collection of over 30,000 images. The exhibition Close to You, the Lisa Belair Picture Show, marks the 10th anniversary of Lisa's passing and showcases a selection of photographs held by the Koori Heritage Trust. The exhibition was curated by close friends and artists Destiny Deacon and Virginia Fraser and cousin Kim Kruger. So in the studio today, I have one of the co-curators, Virginia Fraser. Welcome to Queering the Air on 3CR.
Thank you.
Would you like to introduce yourself?
Sure. I'm an artist and a writer and some occasional curator and an editor as well, so art and art-related activities.
Perfect. So I guess I want to start with what brought you to curating the exhibition, Lisa Belair's exhibition?
Lisa died in 2006, so 10 years ago, and her cousin Kim Kruger had the idea of having an exhibition because there are all these photographs just sort of not quite just lying in the Koori Heritage Trust. So some work had been done on that enormous tangle of photos and necks that she left behind. And then Kim was working full-time and sort of got cold feet, I think, or realised she couldn't do it, and Destiny and I got dragged into it, and then Kim came back into it, and we proceeded that way.
Yeah. And do you feel that each of you brought a very different perspective when working together to curate this exhibition?
Yes. Good question.
I'd love to know more about that.
Well, I ended up doing most of the research because I had the time to do it, really. Kim didn't, and it sort of gave Destiny... made her feel funny. She and Lisa shared various houses for 15 or 20 years, so, you know, it's still a bit of a strange place to be for Destiny. So, yes, we did. I think Kim's was much more to do with promoting Lisa as a person and a kind of more... forgive me, Kim, if I've got this wrong, but a more sort of sentimental feeling about Lisa. And Destiny thought it was a good idea and said she'd be in it as long as she didn't have to go to too many meetings. So she excelled it. So she did more meetings than she wanted to. And I really wanted to sort of make Lisa's photographic practice better known. It's a very interesting photographic practice. And all of us just wanted that big archive not to go to waste, you know, to get it out there and help to continue interest in it.
Yes. And there were over 30,000 images. Did you have to go through all those images?
Probably looked at nearly 20,000, I think. I mean, that most of them are snaps. Lisa really had a snapshot practice, so she went around with a camera taking film photographs mm-hmm. and getting them printed. So most of what's in there is just those little snaps you get back from the chemist, or used to get back from the chemist, or the... So there are a lot of duplicates in it. She made... She always promised people a copy of the photographs that they were in and often made multiple copies, always doubles, I think, and sometimes multiples beyond that. So after a while, as you're going through the boxes, you start seeing the same photograph. So I don't really know how many unique images there are, but there's certainly this huge quantity, of snapshots, some things that have been enlarged and... I forget the word for it now, you know.
Enlarged
and put in a plastic sleeve.
Oh, okay. Yeah.
And that have been used in exhibitions at various universities that she was involved with. And also a huge, a great big archive box absolutely stuffed full of negatives. So who knows, there are probably more in there.
Yeah, that's... Like, what I really love about Lisa's work, and it, you say it here in the catalogue, it's a really great catalogue for anyone who hasn't seen it yet. It's the catalogue for the exhibition. I'm just going to quote you.
Sure.
So in your piece you've written, it's like the piece is called In the Picture, and you say that she used her camera to travel into the middle of situations, to make a world for herself and to draw people in it, symbolically expressed in the way she positioned herself at the centre of most group shots she was in. I found that very interesting as a photographer because I, you know, in the history of photography, it's a very, like, anthropological gaze. There's a hierarchy between the photographer and the subject, or... usually referred to as the object. But in Lisa's photograph, like, I can certainly see how she knew so many people, she was connected to so many people, and she really embedded herself in all the people that she met. So I think that's really amazing of her to do that. And, of course, she's part of those communities as well.
Yeah, the camera helped her to travel. I mean, things... A couple of things you need to know about Lisa, for those who don't, is that she was adopted. So her, she was born in Melbourne in the Royal Women's Hospital, and her mother became ill and went home and put Lisa into the Berry Street Foundling Home, or the baby's home, I think it was. And you could sort of, it was like a boarding house for babies. You could pay some rent and they'd look after the baby. And then her mother died. And I understand that her relatives in northern New South Wales kept up the payments for when they tried to get the baby back. It had been repossessed, as it were, by the state or whatever, and adopted. So Lisa had been adopted and her name was changed. So she didn't know that she was Aboriginal. I think she sort of suspected after a while, but she was told she was Polynesian, and she was sexually exploited by somebody in her adoptive family. And so, you know, there are a lot of... it was kind of a bad start. But she... I mean, part of the point... About Lisa is that she, you know, despite this bad start, she was a very positive person, and she always she connected well with people, and she worked hard at it. She worked hard to be likable, and she was likable. But she really she worked her way into the Koori community in Melbourne from outside. So when she finally got connected, which didn't take very long actually, because her family was looking for her. She, I mean, she's talked about this, about having grown up with sort of quite racist ideas about Aboriginal people, and so she had to deal with all that while discovering that she was one. And so a lot of, I think a lot of the camera and the microphone work was really building bridges for herself. But she was... It's a way of putting herself right into the middle of a community, and she did, you know, she... So it's a really interesting way of going about it. I mean, she had a lot of horrible things happen to her, but she made something really good out of, the things that had happened to her. And her troubles really were as much as... Her troubles really motivated her as much as her sort of, you know, the sunnier side of her nature to do what she did, to get in amongst the community and sort of spread it around.
And, well, when I went to the exhibition, there were, like, a range of photos and, you know, there were lots of photos with police in it as well. Can you talk more about, like, selecting those photos?
Yeah, well, apparently Lisa wanted to, at one point, wanted to be a join the police force, but she ended up, her first degree out of several was as a social worker. Sorry, I'm going to have to cough.
Yeah, sure.
And she always had this sort of, you can see in her photographs, I mean, a lot of photographs are of demonstrations and whatnot, so there are always police present at those. But, you know, you can frame the photographs so the police aren't in them, but she always, it was sort of like, where's Wally? There'd always be at least one. And she also took photographs of police, like she photobombed. There's a picture of her sitting next to a rather uncomfortable-looking policewoman on a train and sitting on the back of a divvy van with two little nieces, training them to take an equalising attitude towards the police. So some of the police photographs, some of those are some of my favourites, actually. They're sort of really dry and funny and...
Yeah, I really like them. I also really like the out black ones.
Yeah,
towards the end, at the end of the gallery, they're really amazing as well. I'd love for you to talk more about the gallery two and what's in gallery two.
Well, there are two galleries at the Trust, two main galleries downstairs, and the first one you just walk into, and the second one's a room that you walk through the first one into gallery two. So the main gallery is the sort of public Lisa, where it's a lot of photographs of demonstrations, NAIDOC, Journey of Healing, a big set of Camp Sovereignty photographs from 2006, which was the year she died, and a lot of photographs of people. So they're sort of party people having fun and portrait people, and there are more of those actually on the second level. But the gallery two downstairs is more like private Lisa, or... So there's a room, a kind of fictionalised version of her room, the house she shared with Destiny, which is just a stud wall with that's lined with something you can see through. And then there's stuff from her room. So it's not her whole room, and it's but it's everything in there except the couch came out of her room. So it just gives you a feeling of...
That intimacy, her
And that there was a sort of more private side to Lisa, because she moved in a lot of different groups, and I can see that, you know, she'd show this friendly... She was really a point of public friendliness in a lot of situations, and so there was this other side to her altogether, this private, domestic side that was more complicated, really. And there are also a couple of slideshows in there, one of her posing with people. So that was a big part of her photographic practice, actually, was to just grab anybody and have a photograph taken. So there's pictures of her with three Victorian premiers, the Angela Davis, with just anybody, famous people, unfamous people. There was a photo of her with Pauline Hanson that we couldn't find. So anybody was completely indiscriminate. If you were a bit famous, she'd pose with you.
Wow, would it be almost like she would get someone else to take the photo, or would it almost be like a selfie?
There are a few selfies. You know, they've got that sort of slightly distorted look, but most of them she's just given the camera to somebody else, or they've taken it and sent her the photo, or grabbed the camera from her, or, you know. But she definitely, I mean, I took a lot of them, so... So anybody who was handy, she'd just give the camera to.
And the camera you have featured in Gallery 2, did she just have one camera or did she have multiple cameras?
She had multiple cameras, sort of successive cameras, really. So they'd get broken or lost, or she'd get a better one. So they gradually got better, and you can see with the older photos, they weren't shot in such good cameras. And then the last camera, the sort of 2006 work, is a pretty good camera, but they're all analog cameras, film cameras.
Yeah, great. Lisa, like as I mentioned earlier in introducing her on the show, she was also a poet, and she was also doing a PhD just before she passed away. And she was also a programmer here at 3CR on Not Another Koori Show, which is incredible. Did you ever get to see those other aspects of her life?
Yes, I did, because I met her through Destiny, mm-hmm. With whom I have a personal and working relationship, and so I met Lisa because she'd shared a house with Destiny. So I saw Destiny a lot, and when Lisa was in Melbourne, there were a couple of times she went away for a couple of years, but I'd see her almost every day. So I saw a lot of Lisa.
Yeah.
So she once she went to university, she never really got out. She did a social work degree, then she worked at the Koori Liaison Office at Melbourne University. Then she did a creative writing. Next, she did a women's studies master's at Melbourne University, then a creative writing master's at Queensland University, and then she was doing this PhD at La Trobe.
Yeah, I heard that she'd written a PhD on the use of radio and photography in Indigenous communities or something like that, and I was like, I want to read that, but she never finished it, is that?
No, she didn't finish it, but there are drafts of sections of it at the Trust.
Oh, really?
In one of the boxes. And she's being given a posthumous PhD by La Trobe University, where she was studying. Mm. And maybe something else will come out of that. And also in the catalogue, some of the sections, there's a sort of a essay-ish thing, which is a compilation of things Lisa wrote about photography from different sources. And a couple of those sections are from her PhD or talks that she gave to PhD classes.
Oh, amazing. I'll definitely have to... Well, I've got the catalogue right here, so I highly recommend everyone check out this exhibition. It's until the 17th of July, is
that
right?
That's right, so it finishes soon.
Yes, very soon. What's the date today? It is like the 10th of July, so in 7 days. So the exhibition is Lisa Belair, Close to You. It's the Lisa Belair Picture Show. It's at the Koori Heritage Trust, which is now at Fed Square. So... please go there and check out the exhibition. It's very, very amazing. And today we've been lucky enough to have one of the co-curators in the studio here, Virginia Fraser. Thank you so much for coming on the show.
That's okay. Thanks very much for having me.
So now we're going to hear a really rare interview that Lisa did with... let me think. Who is the person? So it's an interview that Lisa did with Res Barney on Women on the Line, and this is from 1992. And it's just a short snippet of it, but if you do want to hear the full version, then I'll put the link up on Queering the Air's Facebook. Oh, sorry, Queering the Air's 3CR page. So please check that out. And yes.
You were adopted and fostered, and you were brought up by white people, and you know what, you might have gone to private school, you might have even had a pony. These are some of the stereotypes. And you might even learn to ski, that's another stereotype. Destiny says blacks don't ski. Okay, I put my hand up, but I was adopted, you know, and I'm starting to feel ashamed about that. But there's still that pain that you go through. I mean, nothing that all these material things cannot make up for the loss of not being brought up with your family. And when I met up with my, you know, some more of my relations, I've got hundreds of relations, but I've got family right around Australia too. That's white family and that's my Indigenous family, because there's some, you know, white people that look out for me too. I just cried. I just couldn't deal with it. I just looked around, you know, all this family, and I just, for that split second, I know I shouldn't have, but I couldn't help it. I just kept thinking, I missed out on this.
Lisa Belair is one of the stolen generations of Aboriginal children, and today on Women on the Line, she tells her story. Hello, I'm Ruth Barney. Lisa was one of the contributors to Breaking Through, Women, Work and Careers, edited by Jocelyn Scott. In Breaking Through, Lisa writes, since the invasion, 1 in 6 Aboriginal children has been removed from their natural family. I was one of those victims. Because of the support and love of some close friends who are more like family, I can now call myself a survivor. Adopted as a baby by a white family in 1961, Lisa grew up not knowing that she was Aboriginal. Later, on the pretext of getting a better education, she was sent to boarding school. The real reason, says Lisa, is that she was being sexually abused by her adoptive father. Incredibly, Lisa has overcome these odds to speak out about and work for the rights of Indigenous people in Australia. As a teenager, Lisa says she was inspired by then-Senator Susan Ryan and her outspokenness on women, Aboriginals and education. She says, "I told myself if I stuck at school, attended university, I would be able to work for Susan Ryan in Canberra." Today, Lisa works as the Aboriginal Liaison Officer at Melbourne University and broadcasts on 3CR and 3LO in Melbourne. She's been active in Aboriginal theatre and education and did a stint as a councillor for Collingwood Council. This is Lisa's story.
My mum came down from the north coast of New South Wales, probably 1960, around about then, came down to Melbourne, to Carlton. Actually, she had a job at the Postmaster General, PMG as it used to be called, the old post office, which was also very unusual for a Koori woman, well, a Koori person to actually have a government job back in those days. And she met my dad. I mean, the story's a bit hazy there. And at the time, because she worked, I was in Berry Street Babies Home, East Melbourne, and I guess some of the listeners would be aware then, but, you know, back in the 1960s, could even be before then, you actually paid to have your child minded in Berry Street as opposed to its role now. But in addition to the payment, you signed a document which said that if payment fell in arrears by 4 weeks, then automatically you became a ward of the state. Now, what happened, my mum got really sick. She went home to Lismore in New South Wales. And again, you know, we've got to look at the big picture. And during the 1960s, okay, I was born in 1961, but preceding that, where the federal government and the state government had an official policy of assimilation, okay, assimilation which spelt out in quite detail that Aboriginal people were to become Australian citizens. Here we are talking about assimilation, and we didn't even receive citizenship till 1967. I guess there's a bit of irony in there. So that you had government instrumentalities, example, for the police that would go into Aboriginal people's homes and take children. You had the social workers who played an active role. And you also had things like with my circumstances, how my mum got sick. She went home, and when she was in hospital, of course, she didn't receive medical care with everybody else because she was a Koori, so she was treated in the basement of the hospital. And, you know, I don't know the type of care that she received. She wrote a will saying I was to go to my grandmother, and she died, but before she died, a letter got sent to her saying, well, this will isn't recognised because it wasn't signed by a justice of the peace. So, you know, and in order for me to go home, we need two airfares and adequate winter clothing, so that if, you know, my grandmother, who was raising eight other children, had money for two airfares, then there was adequate winter clothing. And, you know, good question, Ruth, what does adequate winter clothing mean? So it was sort of like, I look at the big picture. It's important to do that in order to try and make sense of what's gone on in this country. And years ago, like, I couldn't even talk about what we're talking about. Like, I do cry. Like, sometimes I'll be in my room, or I'll be walking around the streets because I still don't drive it and have my Ray-Bans on. And you just think about things. You don't necessarily think about you. The only time that I really consciously sort of think about, you know, because you can't be thinking, well, gosh, what if we didn't have assimilation? You know, what if white people didn't invade our country? You know, what if this was a sexist-free, racist-free society? You know, what if, I mean, all I know is what I've gone through. All I know is how I've reacted to that, how angry that I have been in my life. When I was younger, I didn't do things like slash myself. I didn't do things like some Kooris would do, and that's, you know, put acid on their skin to make themselves white, or they'd get stilo wool and scrub their skin. You know, this is all stuff that's happened to Kuris, to Aboriginal people, to Torres Strait Islanders that have been, you know, taken away, fostered, adopted, put in orphanages. It was all supposed to make us good citizens of this country, you know, one nation. And not everyone can speak out on these issues, and it's very painful for me, but it's something that I have an obligation to Australian society, you know, to at least say to people out there, look, please listen, please try and understand. It's no good saying I wasn't here in 1788, but look around what's gone on in more recent history. Look what's gone on, you know, in the 1930s, the 1950s, the 1960s, and we're here in the 1990s. I think everyone wants to be proud of this country, but in order to be proud of whatever it means to be Australian, we've got to acknowledge what's gone on to the Indigenous community in this country.
Well, like you say, you, like so many other Aboriginal children, were taken away from your family and actually adopted out to a white family.
Yeah, and the thing with me, I was told that I was Polynesian. And so when I used to experience a lot of the racism at school, I mean, it's interesting. I mean, it'd be good to be like an outsider and say, well, that's a fascinating experience that, you know, Case LB went through. You know, she was Koori, but she was brought up that she was Polynesian, and what effect did that have on her psyche and her personal development? You know, I can't stand that sort of approach. And I had to go through, like, I mean, when people would call me things like Abbo, Boon, Coon, when I'd get bashed up in the schoolyard for being black, like, I used to think, well, I'm Polynesian. Or I was told that I was Scottish. Well, you know, my adoptive parents, my adoptive father was Scottish, and my adoptive mother was actually born in Waterford in Ireland. And then there was me, and I had an adoptive brother too, which doesn't get mentioned in the story, so this is, you know, for you. And he was white Australian and 4 years older than me, and I'd like to be in contact with him, but I've got to do some research there. So it wasn't until later on in life that I officially found out that I wasn't Polynesian. So I used to get given books and told that, you know, my grandmother was a Polynesian princess, and get books on Hawaii. And at one stage, my adoptive parents were going to move to New Zealand because they said, well, you know, you're Polynesian, and so that means, you know, Maori.
Did they actually know that you were a Koori?
Well, again, you know, I mean, people say that I'm too kind and I'm too generous. That's something that I always want to maintain regardless of wherever I end up, and I'm sure I've got enough aunties and uncles and cousins and friends and people like you that'll keep me on the track, you know, and just sort of say, look, Blair, remember who you are. That when I got my file from Community Services, that was in 1986, that's Community Services of Victoria. When Destiny Deacon, that is, you know, we'd had discussions about, look, you've got to know who you are. And I mean, I knew that, but I was that scared because one of the things is I had prejudices. I was racist, and I'll admit that, you know. So when I mix with, say, white people and they feel uncomfortable about, you know, racism and, you know, how can I understand Aboriginal people? Well, yeah. How can they ever understand an Indigenous person having racism towards other Indigenous people? Now, I know about internalised oppression and internalised racism now. I mean, and going to America really helped me understand what that meant. But prior to that knowledge, I had to work through so much anger. I had to work through my fears because all I knew about Koori people in this country was what I read in the newspapers, what I saw on television, what I heard on the radio, if there was anything on the radio. And predominantly, you know, it tended to be either a success story, and usually a sporting success story. Of course, I'm not saying anything against our fine athletes, who I admire, many of them, or it would be the Aboriginal problem. And there, you know, and there was me. I didn't mix with any people that everyone that I mixed with was white, you know. I couldn't go home and talk about racism. I couldn't go home. Like, I can't explain this. All I know is that when I used to get bashed up because of people thinking that I was different, you know, and an Aboriginal person. I couldn't go home to my adoptive parents. I don't know why I couldn't go home and say, hey, I got dashed up because someone called me black. I protected myself, and so I didn't see myself as black.
We jail black males in Australia nationally at a rate 5 times greater than apartheid South Africa jailed black males in 1993. The suicide and self-harm rates are the highest in the world, and the life expectancy gap is the biggest in the first world. You know, Australians don't like hearing the truth about how bad things are, but the more we resolve from it, the longer this is going to continue.
Black fella, white fella, it doesn't matter what you colour.
Mainstream media is not interested in this stuff. It doesn't find space to talk truthfully and deeply about issues that affect all Australians. The only place, predominantly, you will find that with any real depth is on community radio, and 3CR has been one of the great leaders in that. So if people are wondering where they should spend their hard-earned cash, I would suggest 3CR is a bloody good place to start.
What your name is, we got the hell. Lots of changes, we need more brothers.
Sitting here in a lonely old guest house, I'm sure that my life is all through, scratching free and watching the gray mouse. I'm making love.
And that song is I've Lied by Archie Roach. So just before that, we heard a clipped interview, a Women Online interview that Rez Barney did with Lisa Belair. Yes, we're here in the studio queering the air. I'm Tan Hung and I'm with my host Iris. And in the studio we have co-curator of the Lisa Belair exhibition, Virginia Fraser. So we were just talking very briefly just before we got back on air about how you said that Lisa sounded like very different on... sounded like Lisa, but it didn't sound like Lisa on that recording.
That's not quite right. I mean, it did sound like Lisa. It's interesting that, you know... It's more present hearing somebody's voice than looking at a photograph of them.
Mm-hmm.
So I guess that's what I was saying. And yet there's a sort of a careful but deliberate way of bringing out the story is a thing that she did more in public than in private, I suppose. I mean, it's a public voice. I keep banging on about this. It's sort of interesting, the differences, sometimes slight differences, sometimes big differences between the way we are in public and the way we are in private and with different people and
On. And how do you think, like, her photographic practice, like, what parts of that were very public and what parts of that were private?
I guess it was all both in a way. I mean, it's an interesting thing about her photographs when you see them all collected together that there's a very warm, intimate feel about them because of the way she approached people. So sometimes she would be direct with people. She didn't take a lot of photographs from a distance of people. She was always in amongst it, and you can see that she's got people to look at her. Then in the exhibition, there are lots and lots of people just looking directly at you with quite happy expressions on their faces, aren't they?
Yes.
So it's quite an interesting experience, and that's a sort of an experience she generated for herself with her camera and then took the photos and then passed it on. But you were asking before about radio.
So Lisa had a show here on 3CR, Not Another Koori Show.
Not Another Koori Show Lisa did with Destiny Deacon and Destiny's sister Janina Harding. They did it for quite a long time. And before that they did a show, I think a late night show called The Raspberry Aid Brigade, which I used to listen to when I was in my dark room. So I heard all their voices before I ever met them. Did you have a question, Iris?
Could you go into what Lisa was like on her show, on the shows that she was on 3CR.
But she sounded rather like that, but she was sometimes more bubbly, and she had a very approving interviewing style. So everybody that she interviewed was marvellous, you know. Yeah. So it was more the Annabelle Crabb, something about the election coverage, but more Annabelle Crabb than Barry Cassidy, you know. It was sort of like, oh, it's great, you're great.
Yeah.
And
was that on both shows?
Yes, she was. That was really a method. She was not generally a confrontational person. Sometimes she'd go off pop at people, and give them what for. But on the whole, she was sort of tactful, full of flattery, and you know, more the honeyed approach than the other. And it was sort of interesting because sometimes she'd interview people who, you know, she wasn't at all aligned with, like Andrew Bolt, I remember, was one interviewed, and she just used the same warm, pleasant, you're interesting.
On 3CR, Andrew Bolt.
I think it was on 3CR, And so that produced an unexpected result. I mean, you know, it didn't, she didn't end up making him, you know, she just invited him to speak and he did.
Oh, wow. I wonder how he would have reacted to that kind of approach.
I don't know.
Yeah, it'd be interesting to hear that.
He's we'll have to dig through the archive. Hawk,
Yeah, and do you think that her, like, her photographic practice was, her approach to photography was quite different to doing radio?
No, I think it was all of a piece in a way. I mean, part of it is this thing about putting herself into the middle of things and making personal connections and keeping those alive by connecting with people she'd photographed or interviewed. But the other thing is really working to create a record, you know, to her PhD was, an aspect of it was dealing with photographs and the lack of names on historical photographs of Aboriginal people.
Yes.
So there are some quite famous photographs, Victorian photographs, for instance, that a lot of, you know, you see them published many times, but you don't actually know who those people were. Maybe some people have got an idea that who they were, but, you know, they're not named in the way that a photograph of any of us might be named.
For sure.
Now, there's a picture of Iris, you know. Blah, blah, blah.
And so, like a lack of ownership as well of those historical photographs.
And so a lot of her photographic work and the many interviews that she did were really a way of passing on information. And her photographic archive in the exhibition, which is just one exhibition you could pull out of it, is really... I forget what I was going to say. I got so interested in the idea. it'll come back to me.
Feel free to just shout it out when it comes back to you. Is there... please go.
It's a slice of Melbourne life. It's a slice of Koori life in Melbourne. And also she lived in Brisbane for a while and took photographs of people in Sydney, but most of it's to do with Melbourne. But it's also just a slice of Melbourne life. I mean, you know, there are Indigenous and non-Indigenous people in the photographs. And it's a sort of 20-year... band, you know, of her wide-ranging interests. And it's just very interesting. I mean, I'm sure other people have taken photographs, but maybe not so many. And it's not a kind of fine art kind of practice, although there are some fantastic photographs, really beautiful or arresting photographs. But the big thing about it for me is that she had this rather sort of humble practice. I mean, an ordinary sort of practice, just with a camera and taking snaps. But when you put it all together, there are big stories in it, and a sort of intimacy that's not often associated with... there are a lot of photographs of demonstrations, for instance, and there's very often, whether they're Indigenous or non-Indigenous demonstrations, there's this kind of heroic sort of feel to them, and they're often taken from a distance above or, you know, from outside.
Yeah.
And Lisa's were always inside. Or if they're above, people are looking up and waving at her, you know. And it's a...
relationship.
Yeah, and it shows a community from the inside.
Yeah.
That's what's really interesting important to it about me. And also just the cumulative nature of it. I mean, she didn't have a lot of money a lot of the time because she was studying, and she spent an awful lot of what she had getting these photos printed and buying more film and, you know.
Yeah, it's really incredible. Do you know if it will be possible to have a look at the other photos that the Koori Heritage Trust have, or is that more like for the Koori Heritage Trust and then perhaps in the future?
No, I mean, researchers, you can apply to do some research and that would be the way to do it. And there are other people who are interested in using them. I mean, I think the exhibition is part of the aim of the exhibition was to kind of revive or refresh interest in Lisa's photographs. The longer they sit in there not properly named and so on, the more people forget who's in them. So that was one of the jobs of the exhibition, was to kind of try and add more names to photographs before they drift off.
Yeah. So do you have any final words on, like, your thoughts on the exhibition or Lisa, or like perhaps like a photograph in the exhibition that really stood out for you?
Oh, there are quite a few, really. One of the things I'd say is about 500 individual shots in there, including the slideshows. So if you've ever been to a NAIDOC demonstration or even hung around in the Federation Square, there quite likely is a photograph of you in there somewhere. Go and have a look. You asked me a question.
I think it's, I guess was there a photograph of you in the exhibition that you saw?
I hope not. I actually, Lisa took a lot of bad photos as well as good photos.
Yeah.
And and because I was sort of around a lot, I got a lot of those kind of, I don't know. In the end, I just said, no, please don't show me any more nasty photos. I don't like having my photograph taken anyway.
Yeah.
So there are a couple of photos in the catalogue because everybody who wrote had to have one of themselves.
Yeah.
So maybe I'm in there somewhere.
So go to page, blah, blah, blah.
Yeah, exactly. You see a photograph that's 25 years old. But I hope there are no photographs of me in there. There are more interesting things going on. But that's what it is. It's a slice of Melbourne life, Koori life, public mostly, not always, from ending in 2006, so from about mid-80s, late-80s to the year Lisa died in. And it just gives you a different view of Melbourne, really.
Yeah, it really does. Mm. So I highly recommend everyone to check out that exhibition. Again, it's called Close to You, the Lisa Belair Picture Show. It's on the Koori Heritage Trust at Federation Square, and you can catch it up until the 17th of July. Today's the 10th of July, everyone, so 7 days. Please head down there. And you've been listening to Queering the Air on 3CR Community Radio with myself, Tanhung, and Iris. And we've been joined in the studio by Virginia Fraser, one of the co-curators of the exhibition. It's like only yesterday, but years have gone by. Love that we can smile, connect on the same level. Say what's up and meet the face of my baby nephew. All we got is hope, waiting for a change. Look into the mirror, years to another day. And I can see the part where it's happy, sad times. Trying not to catch you when it's funeral times. I know we will always have the mad bond. Normal break it, then. You've been listening to a 3CR podcast produced in the studios of independent community radio station 3CR in Melbourne, Australia. For more information, go to allthews.3cr.org.au.